Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're sort of pulling focus on three big political threads.
Right.
We've got a major figure's legacy, some really high stakes legal fights, and then this whole wave of local ballot initiatives.
Yeah, it's a lot to connect.
Our mission here is basically to trace how these things link up, you know, how history shapes today's local votes. This is your shortcut to getting up to speed.
Exactly. We're drawing lines between someone who really changed the VP role, the kind of legal battles we're seeing now between prosecutors and, well, partisan attacks, and then how all that national heat is turning local propositions into something bigger. It's strategy, top to bottom.
Okay, so let's dive in with former Vice President Dick Cheney. He passed away at 84, and while the sources really highlight his life as just an amazing story of medical resilience.
Oh, definitely. I mean, first heart attack back in 1978.
Almost 50 years ago.
Yeah, and then multiple major attacks, stents, valve repairs, culminating in that heart transplant in 2012.
And doctors thought he might get another 10 years.
Right, and he got 12. It's really a testament to modern medicine, you know?
Absolutely. But beyond the medical side, it's the political power debate that's really interesting. Some sources are calling him America's most powerful modern vice president.
That's a huge claim. And it suggests, well, a level of power we haven't quite seen replicated.
So where does that idea come from, that he was almost a de facto president?
It really centers on those early George W. Bush years. Cheney brought all this experience, chief of staff, defense secretary, and basically acted like a co-president.
Mm, using that institutional knowledge.
Exactly. But here's the interesting contrast the sources make. He got this immense power early on, but then he kind of got sidelined in Bush's second term, which is different from other really influential VPs. Think Mondale, Gore, even Biden. They kept their influence without that same dramatic fall.
So his power was huge, but maybe unstable?
Volatile, yeah. That seems to be the key takeaway. And the sources actually link him to Mitch McConnell here.
How so?
Arguing that both of them unleashed political forces he ultimately could not control.
Okay, explain that. What forces?
It's about the long-term effects of short-term tactics, specifically turning elections into these culture war referendums. The sources draw a really direct line here. It's not far, they argue, from basing a 2004 campaign on opposing gay marriage to a 2024 campaign focused on opposing trans girls in high school sports. It's that same playbook.
And that kind of chaos had a cost, even for his own family.
Absolutely. It arguably consumed his daughter Liz Cheney's political career in the end, that backlash.
Wow. Okay, before we move on, there's a neat bit of historical trivia. His passing ended the third time in U.S. history we had seven living VPs.
Oh, really? Who was in that group?
Let's see. Quayle, Gore, Cheney himself, Biden, Pence, Harris, and J.D. Vance.
Huh. Quite a list.
Okay, so we see Cheney's long shadow, these forces he helped unleash. Now let's shift to the ground level. How are these dynamics playing out in local contests right now? Let's look at the propositions.
Right. There are about 30 propositions on ballots across the country, which is slightly below the midterm average, interestingly.
But one is getting a lot of national attention, California's Prop 50.
Yeah, this one's really being framed as Governor Gavin Newsom's, quote, first national campaign.
Why national? It's a state prop.
Because the fundraising is national, the messaging is national, and look at the advertising shift. It started as this broad defend democracy message.
Okay.
Now it's much more aggressive, very negative, focused directly on attacking Donald Trump.
And he's got some big names behind it.
Oh, yeah. An all-star team of lefties, as one source put it. You've got Tom Steyer, Obama, Senators Warren and Sanders, Pelosi, AOC. It's a big push.
So the stakes for Newsom personally are pretty high then?
Massive. Absolutely massive. If this loses, it's disastrous for his national image.
Yeah.
If it wins narrowly, well, they'll spin it as a win, sure.
Right.
But only a big win gives him that real momentum he needs to look like a serious national player.
Got it. Okay, let's jump across the country to Maine. Question one there. What's that about?
This one's a conservative push to restrict absentee voting. And the rules are pretty specific.
Yeah, I saw that. No requesting ballots by phone.
Right. And the big one It gets rid of permanent absentee status. So every election, you'd have to go in person to the elections office to request your absentee ballot.
Wow. That seems like a barrier for some people.
For sure. The sources highlight a specific example. Sarah Trites, she's 60, has vision problems, lives near her polling place, but there's no public transit.
So mail-in is her only real option.
Exactly. And this initiative would make that much, much harder for people like her.
And we know who's backing this.
Yep. Funding traces back to a Republican activist, Alex Titcomb, who in turn is backed by Leonard Leo.
Of the Federalist Society, okay.
Maine also has question two, which is about gun safety, allowing courts to temporarily remove guns from someone deemed a threat.
Seems straightforward, but the governor opposes it.
Yeah, Governor Janet Mills argues the police already have enough authority to act. She thinks shifting this responsibility to the courts would actually slow things down.
Huh, making it more dangerous.
That's her argument, yeah. Increases public danger by adding delay.
Interesting. Okay, elsewhere. Colorado's dealing with school meals funding.
Yeah, they have this Healthy School Meals for All program, but there's a $50 million shortfall.
Ouch. So the vote is?
Whether to cover that gap by slightly reducing tax deductions for people earning over $300,000 a year. It's not a new tax, just adjusting deductions.
Okay. And then there's minimum wage popping up again. Olympia, Washington this time.
Right. They're voting on raising it to $20 an hour. Seattle's already at $20.76.
And the national angle here is?
Well, if these cities can implement such high minimum wages without, you know, unemployment skyrocketing, then it could really fuel the argument for raising the federal minimum wage from its current $7.25. Could be a big Democratic issue for 2026.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, last one in this section. Bucks County, Pennsylvania, PA01. Why is this one so important?
Because Bucks County is seen as the bellwether. It's a microcosm of suburban America, crucial for the 2026 House race there between Fitzpatrick, the Republican incumbent, and Harvey, the Democrat.
And there's some serious history at stake in the local races, too.
Get this. Democrats are seriously competing for the district attorney and sheriff roles, offices Republicans have held for over 150 years.
Wait, 150 years? For both?
Well, the sheriff's office, the source says Republicans have held it since 1682.
1682, that can't be right. Let me double check that. Okay, yeah, the office dates back that far, but Republican control is only 150 years or so.
Yeah.
Still, that's incredible institutional history.
Right. That kind of longevity is just staggering. It definitely raises the stakes.
Yeah, the sources use that Benjamin Franklin analogy about the sun painting at the Constitutional Convention.
Ah, the rising or setting sun.
Exactly. Is this a rising sun for Democrats in the suburbs, or is the Republican institutional hold, you know, the setting sun finally fading? Mm. Bucks County is seen as that test case. Hashtag take three. High stakes, legal maneuvering, and counteroffense.
That's a really good way to frame it, actually. From local history to this.
No.
Well, this institutional warfare we're seeing in D.C., let's talk about the Jack Smith standoff.
Right. House Republicans, Jim Jordan leading the charge, demanding Smith testify behind closed doors.
And Smith's response is basically, okay, but not like that.
Yeah, he countered. He said he'd appear, but only if it's public.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And he wants access to all his files, including that volume 2 of his report they haven't released.
Exactly. So why would a public hearing be better for him? Seems risky.
Well, the sources suggest it's his best shot to control the narrative. It's the closest he might get to, quote, try Trump in absentia in the court of public opinion.
Oh, okay. So he can lay out the evidence directly.
Yeah. Think about it. The classified documents, the Mar-a-Lago security tapes showing boxes being moved, that whole flooded room incident. And he gets to present his side.
And push back against the attacks he's facing.
Precisely. Especially since some Senate Republicans, Schmidt, Grassley, are trying to undermine him. Like digging up old news about call log subpoenas.
Right. Trying to paint it as wiretapping.
Even though the logs were known about for ages and didn't contain actual conversations, just numbers called, it feels like a smear tactic. Using old information.
Definitely seems that way. And speaking of pushback, look at what two of Smith's fired prosecutors are doing. Molly Gaston and J.P. Cooney.
What are they up to?
They're starting their own firm specifically to help state and local governments investigate corruption.
Interesting. Why now?
Because the sources argue the main DOJ unit for this, the public integrity section, has been basically gutted. It's been hollowed out.
So they're stepping in to fill that gap at the state and local level.
Exactly. Using their expertise where it's needed. Since the federal capacity is diminished, it's a direct counteraction.
We're seeing a similar dynamic, maybe, with the attempt to go after New York AG Letitia James.
Yeah.
over that second home mortgage in Virginia.
Yeah, the Perrone property case. The accusation was mortgage fraud, getting a lower rate for a secondary residence, but really using it as an investment property.
Okay, break that down. What's the core issue?
It's about the interest rate difference. You typically get a slightly better rate if you declare a property a secondary home, meaning you live there sometimes, versus an investment property you just rent out.
And they accused her of lying to get that better rate.
Right. Claiming she submitted fraud to save, get this, less than $20,000 over the life of the loan.
Doesn't sound like a massive conspiracy. And then evidence came out.
Yes, Politico got hold of a document, part of the mortgage agreement itself, that explicitly allowed her to have exclusive control over the occupancy, including short-term rentals.
So she was allowed to rent it out?
Pretty much. The only restriction seems to have been using a third-party management firm to handle the rentals.
Okay, so for the prosecution to actually prove fraud here, what would they need?
It's a really steep climb. First, they'd have to prove she did use a forbidden management firm. Second, prove she knew she was breaking that specific rule, which is tough with mountains of mortgage paperwork.
Right. Intent is hard to prove.
And third, argue that this relatively minor alleged infraction, saving maybe 20 grand, warrants severe punishment. It just, it looks weak.
So the sources basically suggest this is more political theater.
Yeah, the phrase used is performing for an audience of one, suggesting it's more about scoring political points than a solid legal case. It really seems to fall apart under scrutiny.
Okay, let's shift back to pure electoral strategy. The move by Representative Chuy Garcia in Chicago. That's a fascinating example of modern political maneuvering.
Oh, absolutely. He's 69, been in politics for ages, nearly 40 years. He'd already filed to run again.
And then suddenly retires.
Suddenly retires. But it's the timing that's key.
How so?
He announced he was withdrawing just 1 hour before the official deadline for candidates to declare.
Wow. That's cutting it close.
Deliberately close. Because his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, was ready and waiting. She filed immediately.
Ah. So it effectively cleared the path for her.
Almost certainly spared her a contested primary in that district, which is heavily Democratic D plus 17.
Meaning the Democratic primary winner is virtually guaranteed to win the seat.
Exactly. So it keeps the seat within his preferred political circle, avoids a messy primary fight, very calculated.
That kind of inside baseball calculation, it connects to a broader critique of Democratic strategy that comes up in the source material, doesn't it? Particularly looking at the NYC mayoral race.
It does. There's a sharp critique reported. It contrasts someone like Zohan Mamdani, who focuses on, you know, actual neighborhood campaigning, talking about what people need.
Mm-hmm. Boots on the ground.
With opponents who, the source argues, rely more on stoking fears and just running as not Trump.
So the argument is that some Democrats aren't really making their case.
The argument presented is that some high-level Democrats have maybe over-focused on chasing, quote, rural white or white working-class voters.
Okay.
And in doing so, they kind of take voters of color for granted, treating them like votes they needn't earn simply because the Republican alternative is seen as worse.
And the source basically says that's not a sustainable strategy.
Yeah, the quote is something like, "We will oppress slightly fewer people," isn't exactly a winning message. It's a call for more proactive engagement.
And that gap between messaging and maybe what voters are actually experiencing ties into that weird crime paradox in New York City.
It really does. You have NYPD statistics showing crime is way down, like 50-year lows.
Right. Statistically safer.
But political candidates are still hammering on public safety, which suggests, according to the source, that maybe people's feeling of being unsafe isn't always about crime rates.
But maybe conflated with other visible issues.
Like seeing more homeless people, perhaps. It points to a real disconnect between the data, the lived experience, and the political narratives being pushed. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. We've covered a huge amount today. From, you know, the deep legacy of someone like Cheney to the really intense institutional fights around Jack Smith and Letitia James.
Right, that high-level warfare.
All the way down to these critical local battles. Prop 50 in California, Bucks County, the grassroots stuff.
Yeah, and if you try to tie it all together, what you see in the sources is this real tension. On one hand, you've got these long-term forces, like the kind Cheney unleashed. On the other, you have these very immediate, specific decisions on ballots right now.
So here's the final thought we want to leave you with, something to chew on from all this material.
What happens when national figures, like Newsom with Prop 50, start using those really intense, polarized, almost culture war style messages that used to be mainly for local fights?
Does that nationalize everything?
Does it basically accelerate the very divisiveness, the chaos that figures like Cheney helped start? Does it make every local vote feel like some kind of national emergency?
Yeah.
That's the question to consider.